hit the record button. Is there anything you want to talk about with Alistair? Should we even talk about this?
Yeah, we should talk about that. Why not?
Okay, cool.
I'm excited you made a fun card with awesome shadows over your Sherlock art.
Dude, I found it. I just went Sherlock DeviantArt and boom. I was like, perfect. Done.
Yeah, that is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Stack, your CommanderCast.com's number one source for all fun things that aren't everyone else. I'm Aaron, a.k.a. Uncle Landrops. With me is Eric, a.k.a. Grandpa Growth. And we're here to talk to you, as Grandpa Growth reminded me just before the show, about tangentially all the things in life and sometimes Commander. So today, we have some pretty exciting things. Yeah, we've already got Gramps laughing.
Yeah, just another Oscar-winning performance on the intro here.
I'm trying. I try really hard. It's my favorite part.
Eat your heart out, Leonardo DiCaprio.
It's my favorite part. I just, for whatever reason, every time I get ready to do that, I hear like Good Morning Vietnam, like Robin Williams, and it just jacks me up. I really like intros. In my head, obviously. So we've got some exciting things to talk about in the world of magic. But first, we're going to talk about not magic. So my favorite thing that's come off on Twitter this week is actually something that I saw reposted from Robert Schuster. So tangentially, it is once again about magic. Lupe Fiasco defeated the world champion Street Fighter champion. Now, if you guys don't know who Lupe Fiasco is, he is a pretty famous rapper, relatively, right, Eric? I mean, he's more popular than B.O.B. He has to be.
He's like, no, I don't know if he's more popular than B.O.B. because like his biggest songs came out several years ago, whereas B.O.B.'s most popular songs came out like maybe just two or three.
Oh, okay.
I would give him like B-list celebrity status.
Okay.
And just to be clear, he defeated the Street Fighter World Champion in the video game Street Fighter.
Yes, he did not fight.
He did not literally fight someone in the street. Although, who knows? He's expanding into new territories. Maybe he will become the world's greatest Street Fighter in addition to Street Fighter player.
Let me tell you, folks. There's a lot of reasons to like Lupe Fiasco. Unlike B.O.B., he seems like he's got a pretty interesting head on his shoulders. The guy has helped develop a nutrition app. He has not only in addition to his rap career, and then he's also, you know, become pretty much a Street Fighter aficionado and strategist. And if you watch, we'll put a link in the show notes to the 20-minute throwdown he had with Daigo Umehara. And you guys can check it out and see just how good his moves are. There's a lot of people on Reddit that are clamoring and saying that Daigo threw the fight and then he's just so good that he can make it look interesting. What are your thoughts on that, Gramps?
Well, I'm not familiar with this Daigo character. I'm also not in on the competitive gaming world of Street Fighter, so I would not be able to tell if he threw the fight or not. I will say that David Serlin, who I've mentioned before on the show, was a former professional Street Fighter player. And he wrote, you know, this book about game design and game strategy that I basically use as like the Bible for all of my strategy articles. You know, one of the formative influences on my writing. So it's interesting to me that like this is Street Fighter in particular. You know, it's not as one of the Killer Instinct. One of the people on Facebook when you posted this was like, oh, he's black, he probably played Killer Instinct. And, you know, you commented on that and was like, well, that's a, you know, a very interesting racial stereotype. And I just had a total head scratch moment of like, first of all, this is just like a weird story. Like, why does rapper guy win, you know, an exhibition match against a professional video gamer who presumably does that all day? Like, but then the social media people just can say anything, right? And they just get away with it. And there's no one there with a flip-flop to hit them in the head, you know, when they say something stupid.
Yeah.
So
flip-flop is the preferred weapon.
I mean, or newspaper. Like, what? I don't know. I just don't know. What do you do to stupid people to, like, correct their behavior? I mean, I want to punish it, but also, like, I just want it to never happen again. That's what my primary goal is.
Yeah.
Please don't say weird, racist, potentially funny, but also, like, demeaning things.
Yeah.
On social media.
I mean, I have a laugh at ridiculous things like that all the time, and I would never have known that black people would be good at Killer Instinct. I can't imagine that that's a thing.
There's no way that's a thing.
There's no like, way.
I mean, if you're a professional Killer Instinct player and you want to weigh in on this,
please
tweet at us, because now we're interested. Now we're going to be investigating the demographics of top-level fighting game tournaments.
Yeah, I mean, the only people that I might know in like the Magic world, I know LSV used to play Street Fighter, I think, before he became a Magic player. He used to play like pretty competitively, and he would, you know, he's talked about that on Limited Resources a couple of times, but... You know, so maybe he's the only person we know that, or we know, quote unquote, that could weigh in on this particular interesting development, I would have to say.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, you know, sort of what I wanted to say about this, you know, David Sirlin book and like why it was so influential on my writing about strategy is that people don't necessarily know, but Street Fighter II was like the competitive game for almost a decade. You know, now you see people play League of Legends or Dota or StarCraft, and those are super popular games that are at the top of competitive gaming right now. But back in the day, when Super Nintendo and like arcade cabinets, early 90s, late 80s era, Street Fighter was where it's at. Like that was right. What everyone was playing if you're trying to be real, you know, not just assert your dominance, you know, winning quarters from the kids, but like... winning $50,000 in a tournament in Las Vegas kind of shit.
Right, right. And so that's, I think, pretty much what we wanted to mention. Like I said, you guys need to watch this Lupe Fiasco beatdown on Daigo Umehara. I think it's pretty cool. As always, we since we plugged B.O.B.'s album, looks like Lupe has like three different albums coming out pretty soon, or scheduled to come out this year. So be sure to check him out, because he's one of my favorites.
Yeah, easily more intelligent than B.O.B. I think we can confirm that. I don't know anything about black people and what video games
are. Killer Instinct.
But I do know that people who think Earth is flat, not as well informed as people who release, you know, multiple albums in the same year, get major consulting fees for some technology, you know, iPhone app. Yeah. Like, he's multidimensional. And he's learned some basic, you know... geography.
Yeah, he's
two thumbs
cool
up.
Dude. Pretty cool dude. Okay, so we've got our nonsense out of the way. Let's get into Pro Tour Oath of the Gatewatch. So this just happened like what was it? 2 weekends ago?
No. Yeah, 2 weeks ago. And well, I want to do some follow up because
from the time we're recording this, obviously. We're like months, yeah.
If you're listening to this as it goes up on the site, I don't know how else you'd be listening to it, but
yeah.
You've probably heard us mention several times, we record well in advance of the posting date, so everything we say is always out of date. That's why we get to be wrong, and you know, by the time you hear it, we'll have figured it out.
Yep.
Anyway, as of the recording of our last episode, I had not yet seen any of the coverage from Oath of the Gatewatch. I have now gotten around to watching the top eight and also LSV versus Frank Lepore.
Yeah.
And... you know, congrats to Frank Lepore for a very good showing in his first Pro Tour ever. I did not realize that was his first Pro Tour.
Me neither. I heard about it. I actually listened to MTA Cast because they had some really cool unofficial coverage from Pro Tour Oath of the Gatewatch. They interviewed all the pros that were in the thing, and they got to interview Frank, and that's when I found out.
Hmm. Yeah, well, he's been around the game for a long time, and he's been an author and, you know, community member. He makes content, videos. He does, I think, a couple different series of videos, at least throughout the last couple of years. I don't know what he's currently doing. But he, in my recollection, focused on Standard.
Yes.
So sort of interesting that he has this huge breakout performance at a modern Pro Tour with a new format where, like, you'd think, I guess, anybody has a chance. But then, like, the more chances you give to everyone else, doesn't it just favor the long-term pros who, like, yeah, they've seen this, you know, song and dance many times over.
Yeah.
But hey, you know what? He did great. That's awesome. And the LSV match with Frank was a classic. No spoilers for anyone out there, but I will say this involved a top deck on the same level as this famous GIF.
The Nassif GIF, are you talking about?
Well, no, not quite that much. I was talking about the one where LSV is on team. I can't remember what event this is, but like they're playing a team Grand Prix, and they lose. The LSV's team loses because guy flips over a miracled Bonfire of the Damned, and he just has this priceless face. I'll see if I can find the GIF.
Okay, cool.
For the show notes, This was an equal top deck and equally GIF-worthy.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things I wanted to mention about what's cool about Frank Lepore, and I think really respectable too, is that, I mean, of course he was playing Eldrazi, but he was actually playing like a variant that wasn't the blue-red deck, that wasn't the colorless version. It was something kind of in between. And I thought that was, you know, again, another cool thing, a cool testament to Frank Lepore that he kind of got there with his own thing developing without having to, you know, kind of get some insight from other people, more or less. I mean, obviously he's going to be doing playtesting and doing stuff with other people, but you know, it wasn't from these big teams that found these decks and were just like, yeah, let's go.
Well, his list is substantially similar.
Right.
I mean, there definitely was variation in the Eldrazi lists that were there, but I think what makes the Eldrazi list good is that they have this, you know, four of Ghost Quarter is pretty good. But then they have this core of cheap colorless creatures that allow them to play more utility lands than they should really get away with. They have Dismember, which is, you know, another likely mistake from the design department, you know. So there's just like this critical mass now of colorless spells. So everyone can play four Ghost Coders and four Mutavaults and get away with only one basic and one Urborg in their deck. And like, that's a mana base suddenly.
Yeah, pretty insane. So, yeah, so moving on, you wanted to talk about the Eye of Ugin. So, yeah.
Yeah, there were like 150 Eye of Ugins in the top eight. I don't know what the exact number is. I think it was 36.
Yeah.
But there were just so many Eldrazi decks at the top tables in this tournament. And a lot of the reason that the ECI gave for why they wanted to ban Splinter Twin was that it was stifling format diversity and it was just showing up too much. It was too large a percentage in that game, what have you. Well, in the aftermath of that banning decision, you have a Pro Tour in Modern, which is usually a pretty wide open format. At least there's several playable decks. And now, you know, six of the eight people in the top eight were playing substantially the same list. And going forward in the future, obviously, now that one of those decks has actually won the tournament, that will become like the popular dominant deck. So you'll see that one even more often. Feels like the ban backfired a little bit to me.
Okay. I mean, I think you could look at it that way, but I think you could also look at it as, you know, the top eight isn't, I don't know if the people who, the banning committee and all these people want the top eight to have some kind of representative of the larger population, because from what I understood from LSV, the Eldrazi deck wasn't popular at the thing. You know, there was two teams that were playing it and they just had it figured out. But maybe that's just me like misunderstanding what he said completely.
No, you're right. The Eldrazi deck was not the most played deck at all in the format, but I'm saying it will be the most played deck in Modern, you know, daily events, online Grand Prix. I'm not sure exactly what the premier schedule is for Modern in the upcoming season, but this will be the deck to beat going forward. So by banning a popular deck right before they have this new set come out that powers up this Eldrazi strategy, they sort of don't know which one of these two decks was better. Like, would everyone have just played Splinter Twin if it wasn't banned? Or would this deck still have been the best? We don't really get to see that play out in a natural way.
That's true.
Splinter Twin's just gone, period. Now we have, you know, the full house, basically, of Eye of Ugin decks in the top eight of this Pro Tour. And we have another banned and restricted list announcement coming up in April. if they ban Splinter Twin because it was too popular or too dominant, whatever, it's hard to see how Iabugan, you know, is not an equally dominant card to Splinter Twin.
Yeah.
I stand by my earlier comment from the previous episode where, like, I think the metagame will settle down and, like, yeah, this is popular deck right now, but it will not be the quote-unquote best deck forever. I do think there are better strategies to be found, and I don't think Modern is solved. But I think that a great deck for this tournament. The deck is strong. It can do great things. But I stand by my assertion that Blue will come back.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think that Blue has to come back. And we're gonna see some new decks in Modern that are going to be not only able to beat the Eldrazi deck, but they're going to be able to beat some of the other contenders like Affinity. I mean, that's the big one, right? Other than Eldrazi at this point, is that, you know, this is the one that's stuck around. This is the one that people know. They've got to be able to beat that. They've got to be able to beat this weird Eldrazi deck. And I'm not sure that control decks can necessarily beat it without some decent removal spell that hits the Reality Smasher, because that's the big bopper right there.
Yeah, Reality Smasher did certainly smash quite a lot of face in that top eight. It was, not the most played card, being that it is relatively expensive by Modern standards.
Yeah.
In terms of mana cost, not dollars.
Yeah, right.
But you get a decent amount of value for that 5-mana investment, particularly when your 5-mana really only means 3 land drops. You know, it's sort of like the biggest 3-drop around, given that your lands are completely broken.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you can go turn 1 Mimic, turn 2 Thought Knot, turn 3 Reality Smasher, it's so dumb. Like, that's really dumb.
Yeah, there you have a deck, and that's been true in Modern for a long time, where, like, decks can have a nut draw that's basically like, ugh, how was I ever intended to beat this? The tools just don't exist, right? That's certainly true of Eldrazi, but I think that on balance, the deck is actually pretty slow. I think Affinity was like a little slow. You know, Affinity's hung around in Modern for a long time, and it's supposed to be like the fast deck, but it really never has been. I think it's always been too slow, and I think that in terms of just Goldfish speed, the Eldrazi deck is very similar. So there, that presents an avenue to beat it. If another combo deck is capable of coming in and winning on turn 4, then that will become the new dominant strategy, I have no doubt, because this Eldrazi deck has very few interactive elements. Thought Knot Seer is great, and Thought Knot Seer definitely overperformed in this Pro Tour. It had a lot of shining moments. Card is actually quite good.
Oh, man. It's almost – I think it's literally like Thoughtseize but a creature. It's like the Thoughtseize dude. I don't know. It was because of the way that the mana base is specifically. Like not any other reason. It was so crazy.
Yeah, it's edging in on like Vendilion Click levels of power.
Yeah.
Particularly because of how the replacement mechanic works. So like you get to take away their card and it could be any card and it's just gone. It actually is exiled, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
But they don't get their card, you know, get to draw their card again until they actually deal with the Thought Knot Seer. But the thing is, Thought Knot Seer attacks for quite a bit of damage.
Yeah.
And you could very well die or be, you know, so low on life that that card no longer matters by the time you get around to dealing with a 4-4, you know.
Yeah.
It's bulletproof, and their deck, it only plays a few, but it does play basic lands, so pathing it is not super helpful considering they want to get to a 5-cost spell. Like, this deck does need to hit its land drops. It is quite the card. It really enables the strategy. It's kind of the glue. You can do silly things with Eldrazi Temple. You can do silly things with Iabugan. Iabugan has been played in many decks in Modern to great success. Tron, for example. Mm-hmm. But Thought Knot Seer gives it just that little bit of extra edge that, okay, we only have to play against 6 cards now, and it's their 6 worst cards because we exiled that removal spell or whatever that could have potentially dealt with our creatures.
Yeah.
It's pretty sweet.
Or their Reality Smasher, which is even dumber.
Or their Reality Smasher. There was quite a bit of, I guess, redundant play.
Yeah.
If you watch the top 8, you're going to see the same lines over and over again. Like, Thought Not their Thought Not, or Thought Not their Drowner of Hope.
Yeah.
And you're going to see a lot of ghost quarters being aimed at each other's Ivugin. It's just, yeah. Oh man. there was a whole heck of a lot of that. And probably, you know, we haven't mentioned this, but Eldrazi Mimic, which we will actually be talking about a little bit later in the show. This sort of gives like some amount of hasty damage to these creatures because, you know, you have a 2/1. The next turn you play your 4/4, but like you're no longer attacking for 2. The mimic attacks for 4 now. So like 2 of that damage was hasty thanks to your Thought Knots here, which is pretty sweet. Again, like these little tiny bits of curve beating value. You know, you don't usually get a 4/4 for 2. In modern,
it actually kind of reminds me of the Animar deck, right? I mean, because basically what you're doing is once you get Animar out, you kind of have this colorless mana floating around, and you're able to not only channel it into to making it more Animar power the more creatures you cast, but even the mirrors and the creatures that I was playing in that Animar deck, you know, once Hellrider came out or something, you know, like that, you instantly had a creature buff like the flip card, Instigator Gang. Once those cards came out, those guys became actual weapons, you know? And it kind of seems like Eldrazi Mimic has that enabler ability about it. And that's something I didn't expect at all, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's definitely going to be an interesting deck going forward. I think I will say this, though. I think the metagame can very easily react to this because the Eldrazi deck is essentially like 100% creatures.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, what do they do if they don't have creatures? And like any deck with a board sweeper can probably beat Eldrazi.
Yeah. I mean, especially anything that you can get that's not aimed at Reality Smasher, right? Because, and if you just play removal that's not targetable, that's probably one of the better ways to beat this deck.
Yeah. Maybe we'll see Gifts Ungiven. That's what I'm rooting for.
The hope. Hold out hope for that.
All right. Yep. Moving on, we have some more Investigate token speculation for Eldritch Moon, the upcoming, I guess, not actually upcoming, but soon to be released in a year from now.
Well, yeah. Well, Shadows and Eldritch Moon, Shadows over Innistrad coming out next, and then Eldritch Moon coming out when the core set should have come out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, so one of the things that I was looking through, speculation and trying to see what people are talking about with Shadows and what the opinions were. I think the prevailing opinion is that people were like, is Emrakul going to be back? And Brainstorm Brewery, when Shadows over Innistrad was announced, credit to them, because I'm not like super nerdy when it comes to Lovecraft. Even though I read a lot of books occasionally, I have not read a single Lovecraft novel. But I plan on reading The Shadow over Innsmouth, which is sort of what they were talking about in this article, is that, if Shadows over Innistrad is the name of the new set, Shadow over Innsmouth is a Lovecraft novel. They feel like, you know, this was just not a mistake, that the Wizards employees, created this idea, and they never do anything like this that's not... not just like, oh, that's a happy coincidence. So this led them to believe that Emrakul is going to be back. And then when Eldritch Moon was announced, Melissa de Toro did that last week, I believe, in our time, in pre-recorded time, we'll call it. The Eldritch Moon almost confirms it because Eldritch is a word that's really commonly associated with Lovecraft novels. It's a Scottish origin. And it's originally meant to imply elven things, but it's actually meant to evolve to mean strange, weird, ghostly, or uncanny. So what are your thoughts on this, Gramps?
I will be very excited for this if that is in fact the case, because I don't know if you recall, but that was my official prediction for what the Shadow over Innistrad in fact is.
Well, there's
I think the Shadow is going to be quite literal.
Well, there's
That'd
two.
Be sweet.
There's two, though. There's Shadow. It's Shadows over Innistrad. It's not just Shadow.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, he has his whole, it has its whole brood lineage thing. Like, I feel like it's not going to be alone. It's, It's kind of like the ship from Independence Day. It's just like this big flying saucer that releases little things, and like they go and terrorize you. But like, it never really does anything important. It just sort of like floats there so that David Goldblum can fly up inside it. David Goldblum. Yes, Jeff Goldblum. Sorry.
Combination of David Lee Roth and Jeff Goldblum.
Talk about happy accidents. Yeah.
Okay. So. I think this makes me more excited about it. When you told me that Shadows was the next set, I was actually really disappointed. I think I'm the only person. I liked Innistrad originally, but I guess I'm just not like the minute that somebody starts getting hyped, I'm not like the person that is gonna be like, yeah, I'm riding your hype train. You have to give me more than just a little bit of the fruit roll up before I want to, you know, enjoy fruit roll ups, I guess. Is the really
what
poor
the
metaphor.
Hell?
Yeah. You have to give me a little bit of the fruit roll up. A little more of the fruit roll up as a sample, you know. I don't know what I'm saying.
Metaphor of the century. So listen, guys. This show's not scripted, okay? Like, this is just two guys on a Skype call.
Trying to
bouncing ideas. Yeah, like we say we say ah, we say like. This is real.
Yeah.
We're trying to feel this. Live in the moment with us,
yeah,
where we stutter and say things like David Goldblum.
Yep. Oh, I was listening back to our older or one of our podcasts. I think it was episode 12 because that just got released like last week. And there's some really good Gramps isms. I forgot what it was. It was something like, I wish I could remember them. They're fantastic. They're in episode 12. And he's a much better speaker than me, even when he screws up. So,
well, if you're gonna bring it up, you have to, you know, jot down some examples for next time.
Yeah,
Calvin, you have two options: either cut this or cut in my quotable sound bites from episode 12, whatever they are.
Just complete malapropisms, just really great, fantastic ones.
Ah, yes, yeah. Those are pretty good. Malapropism. Have you? Do you read XKCD?
What's that?
It is a webcomic.
No.
About a great many things, but it's like very sciencey and very dark humor.
Okay.
They have a good comic about malapropisms, which we will have to link in the show notes now that I've mentioned it. But you guys should read XKCD. It's super funny. Comes out 3 times a week and it takes like 30 seconds to read, and it's always worth it, in my opinion.
You heard it from Gramps. Read it. So yeah, I'm actually more excited now because I do tend to like things that are more of the atypical when it comes to fantasy stuff, or, you know, just taking something old and making it into a different thing that makes me interested in other things. So my hope is that Shadows over Innistrad and Eldritch Moon might get me more interested in some of these other Cthulhu-y Arkham Horror kind of games, or even, you know, just reading a little bit more Lovecraftian stuff.
Yeah, I'm glad you reminded me of that. I will have to put Shadow over Innsmouth on my reading list. Necronomicon is currently in my queue. I'm like six books away from it or something like that. So, you know, within the next couple months, I will have read my first H.P. Lovecraft story.
Jesus, that is terrifying.
I mean,
the Necronomicon.
What other book should I read, really? Like, if you're going to read one book, how could it not be that?
If you're going to read one book this summer.
Make sure it's by H.P. Lovecraft, essentially.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, cool. All righty. So we got a lot of interesting insights out of the way. It's time for our flavor question of the week, and it's brought to you by Grandpa Growth.
Aaron, how do clones work?
So I prepared a statement for Eric to explain to him how I believe that clones work. So from a flavor standpoint, I think what Gramps is trying to say is that it doesn't make any sense that my creature is the same as your creature. Right?
Correct.
Okay. So here's the deal. What clone as a card is essentially it's an understanding that you are a much more clever mage or planeswalker than your opponent is. It's the idea that everything that's in your deck is also in my deck too, because I can cast it for 3 and a blue. whereas you have to spend eight, you know, five rug on a Maelstrom Wanderer, I can cast clone and make my own Maelstrom Wanderer. That's how clones work.
Well, that's actually not how clones work in the rules, but
okay. So where do we need to break it down? What are you missing?
This is a strictly flavor question. We're well aware of how clones work in the mechanics of Magic the Gathering.
Yeah.
But I have questions like, so you have a Snapcaster and he's got, as we discussed in previous episodes, the little like X-Buster blaster thing on his arm that allows him to cast spells from the past. I don't know. Like that, you know, is flavor. That's how it works. Sure.
Yep. Ken Jeong casts flavor from the past.
Yeah. He has a device that allows him to do this. Now, if I make a clone, does my clone somehow – it's like he's a shapeshifter, right? He, she, it. Yeah. Like what does gender mean when you can change your sexual organs at will? Regardless. So like a thing that can morph its body, can it actually do that with sufficient levels of detail to replicate the Snapcaster blaster? I don't think so. Like it doesn't make sense to me that you should be able to copy things – of a technological basis or that are themselves unique or like the Eldrazi are supposed to be incomprehensible or like they work in a way that our natural biology cannot comply with, cannot, you know, find any congruency with. So I feel like clones are big offenders in the flavor department for me this week. I'm just like,
So because they can't clone Eldrazi is what you're saying?
No, because they can, but they shouldn't be able to.
Okay. So what would you do to fix that? Like, how would you fix that in the rules?
No, you don't fix it in the rules. I'm just saying that the flavor of magic is kind of dumb. And that clones should not exist.
We're living in your world, Eric. I want to live in your world. I want to understand how you would create a system where clones would not be able to copy Eldrazi. Like this is the problem. This is the problem that you're having with the flavor fail, is that it's such a mess that nobody wants to, you know, do it. It's the really bad workroom at your job where like everybody just piles their shit in and it's just like, well, fuck, you know, we don't want to go into that gender closet 3 because that sucks.
here's some top level principles. So if something is a creature, it's only a creature and not like the equipment that comes with it. So like a soldier is a soldier, but he is not in fact the armaments that he's carrying, because we've seen that swords, shields, armor, those are equipment. So if you're copying the creature and you're not copying the equipment attached to that creature, you shouldn't get his equipment flavor wise. Now, I don't think you should be able to copy legendary creatures either. For obvious reasons, legendary things are unique. They have singular powers, even though they may be similar to other creatures or, in fact, be a member of some established creature species, like, you know, human. But not all humans are created equal. And, like, what makes this particular legendary creature unique is something that other humans don't have. So if all you can do is morph your body into the shape of a human, you might be able to fool the guard at the door, but that does not mean that you can, you know, found Apple computer.
Yeah. Okay. I see what you're saying. Point about the legends. I think that would be a really great rules adjustment that Magic can make in design that would make it fundamentally better, is that like you just can't copy legendary creatures. Like that would be that would make the games way more interesting, dude. Oh my god.
Well, that would actually be a twofer flavor win, because like in Commander, or actually any game now, where like the legend rule works in such a way that like you can have multiple copies of the same legendary creature in play on every side of the table. Which, if you have a multiplayer game and like we all have our own copy, or like, you know, we all have our own Jace the Mind Sculptor, this gets exceedingly strange flavor wise. And just be cool if, like, you know, clones, you can't do that. Sorry, guys.
It would be, well, I think that would be a really great addition to this game, actually. I think that, well, number one, from the legendary creature side of this equation here, there's really nothing other than the fact that it just says legendary creature on the card anymore. That makes it really unique. There used to be a lot of different rules for them, but now they're all gone. And I think that that would make the games a little bit more interesting. There'd be quite a bit of rules text that would have to be errated over in Oracle Gatherer Land. But I think it would be really cool, actually. I think that that would be an element to the game that I would be for. Because, it streamlines games. It makes rules a little bit more elegant. And it makes legendary creatures worthy of a card type, you know, of the super type.
Well, then what version of the legend rule do you use if you want to adopt this idea?
Well, it's just more about errating the clones text. It's not really errating. It's just using that to make them more powerful.
So just change clones, not change legendary creatures.
Well, you just say it enters the battlefield as a copy of any non-legendary creature on the battlefield. That's all you have to change.
Okay.
On actual clone. Now, on some of these other creatures, you know, like Evil Twin, things like that, it would be pretty much the same thing, I guess.
Evil Twin gets me thinking even more. So, like, Evil Twin sort of implies that the Evil Twin is the superior twin, because, like, anytime it chooses, it could just go kill the original because it's so superior, right?
Well, I think in Magic, that's a more superior plan, is to have the removal for somebody else's thing, which makes it superior in your head. I don't know if that makes
it better. Yeah. Okay. That as a clone mechanic is great. It's like, you have a cool thing. Now I have a cool thing that has the added ability to get rid of your cool thing. That is so much better than just copying.
Yeah.
This, like, why is mind control better than clone? You know, volumes could be written on this topic, but it's because not only do you get their thing, they lose their thing.
Yeah.
Now, this is cool in, you know, the mechanics of the game, obviously, but flavor-wise, if something is really awesome and really unique, like Imrakul, for example, and you evil twin someone's Imrakul, how is your, you know, doppelganger Imrakul first as cool as, but then secondly, more stronger, like, somehow? I don't know.
I think it's Evolmercruel. I think that's how you say that. Evolmercruel. Because Okay, so.
I don't know if Evil Twin should exist, and it's like, I feel like that's a flavor affront. If I copy your Imrakul, you know, the copy of Imrakul does not somehow get the ability to instantly assassinate other Imrakuls. Well, now that doesn't make sense in flavor.
That's true. I mean, as far as that goes, I guess I still don't see the issue here. Like, I feel like clones, you know, it's just the ability of you as a planeswalker relative to the game that allows you to be to make your clone, you know, make a copy of whatever your other opponent has.
Yeah. Well, that's obviously the best explanation I think that we're going to get.
Yeah.
I was just sort of musing about these clones. They are shapeshifters themselves, and like, they exist naturally in some planes.
Well, so
like Renegade Doppelganger, for example, you know.
Yeah.
It's shown in the art as like changing into an Eldrazi that it has just encountered, and like, that sounds cool and all, but it's not, I guess, technically, if we think of it in its natural environment, not as you'd summon it on the battlefield in your giant wizard fight. I think actually the salient issue we're getting at here is that I think the flavor of Magic doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I mean, that's the great part about it though, right? I mean,
there are a number of unresolved inconsistencies that I would like to address, but will never be able to do so to my satisfaction.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. So Renegade Doppelganger is a completely different kind of clone. And this is the part that's weird to me, is like, the Renegade Doppelganger clone and the Eldrazi Mimic that we promised to talk about, that I'm now talking about, these guys are weird in the way that they work to me, because of the way that they interact with various parts of the card or various things. So you also have the one from Mirrodin block, Scars of Mirrodin block, that's the blue-blue colorless one that at the beginning of your upkeep, you can choose a creature and it becomes that copy. You also have Halfdane, which is a really fucking weird card. I mean, you know, it's like either you get to either have this power and toughness or half damage just a 3/3. Either way, you get something. It's so weird.
Yeah.
These are the clones that don't work to me. Now, in your head, if you're thinking about, like, you know, if Snap, going back to Snapcaster, right? Does your clone Snapcaster get the Snap Blaster? Maybe. I would like to think that they're like jelly versions of the other card, right? So you get jelly Terastodon if you clone somebody else's Terastodon. Because you got a blue creature, and it looks like jelly, like a lot of times, like the clones. I mean, other than like the original artwork where you've got the two guys that are kind of looking at each other. I forgot who did that art. It's somebody. It's a good artist. I can't. An original clone art.
I don't know who it is off the top of my head.
Okay, me neither. We're moving on.
Christopher Rush is my official guess.
Okay, well, I'm looking it up. Survey says.
Speaking of Christopher Rush.
Pouring out of 40.
We have.
It's Critchlow. It's Carl Critchlow. Oh, whoa. Hold on.
Carl Critchlow is the Onslaught remake.
Okay. Julie Barrow.
Barrow is the original Alpha, interestingly. Now that we both had to look that up on the fly.
Yeah. Yes. So, anyway, you know, this is not the imaginary thing of clone that I think of when I think of clone. I don't think it's an exact copy looking. I think it's just a jellier version of the other card.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Well, before I move on, I shoehorned Christopher Rush into that discussion because he's super dead.
Yeah.
Maybe that's insensitive, but
I'm pouring out.
He was loved and will be missed. Yeah, exactly. It's time to pour out the 40 because he was pretty sweet.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And it's just so sad. You know, when, I mean, it was him and who's the other one that passed away recently too? There's another guy that passed away very recently. I don't remember.
People be dying all the time, I think, is the real sad part.
Yeah, like Alan Rickman. What the hell? Come on, dude.
Oh yeah, dude. This has been a bad year in a lot of ways.
January. We already have Alan Rickman dead, David Bowie dead. What is going on 2016? If you know what's going on in 2016, you should tweet at me.
It's the stock market, dude.
Yeah.
That's what everybody just checks their accounts and they're like, off. Shuffling off the mortal coil. Tired of this shit. I didn't animate magic cards for 3 years to, you know, have my 401k tank like this. Brr.
Yeah, the last check he cashed, it bounced. I hope. I can only hope, Christopher Rush, if you can hear me.
Maybe we need to have a seance to get in touch with our dead homies. Next episode, we should have top 5 dead homies.
Yeah, top 5 dead homies coming at you on episode 19. So, next topic is the habits we've stopped or started doing since we began playing Commander. These are just Commander-related playing things that Eric and I have adapted to over the years. Just, you know, evolving our play styles, evolving the methodical ways that we go about doing things. Magic starts out as a game, but I think it changes us in the way that we prepare for it as we take it more seriously and we get more involved in the community and do it, you know, with our friends and doing what we want to do. So Eric and I want to kind of have a discussion about this for a little while. But before we go on to our last super fun card discussion.
Well, I want to clarify quickly. This is habits related to magic, right? I started going to the gym every week since I began playing Commander.
No,
okay.
I don't care about you going to the gym. I'm sure you do.
Me neither, because that never happens. All right. Well, do you want to kick it off? What's something you've done since you began playing Commander?
Okay. So one of the biggest changes I made was a couple of years ago. And I stopped playing Magic when I was angry or upset or wasn't just ready to have fun. So the story about this is that a lot of my stories will stem from the night that I was playing Eric with my crappy Good Stuff Entet deck, and I lost a bunch of games, and I threw it against the wall. This is the story. And from there, I've definitely, I think that's the point where I started making a lot of changes to the way that I not only build decks, not only play decks, but also just developed a discipline for all of these different things in the ways that I wanted to do them, and not just like what I thought Eric thought was good or what I thought somebody else thought was good. I did it for me. And the biggest thing is not playing angry. And that's really important to me, because when I get into a game, I don't want to be frustrated about playing Magic. I don't want to frustrate my opponents playing Magic. I want to challenge them in a healthy way, and I want to be tough, and I want to be a strong opponent, but I also don't want to be, use things from outside of the game and bring them into Magic when I'm just trying to have fun, because that's what it's all about. So that's my biggest, one of my biggest changes is that I've stopped playing Magic angry. So like, if there's something in my life that's just making me really upset and it's pissing me off, I don't go play. And maybe that's a little unhealthy, but, because, you know, now I'm not relieving my stress in the way that I, you know, would when I would play Magic. But, I found that trying to solve my other problems outside contributes to a lot more success and high highs when I'm playing Magic.
Well, I mean, I feel like that actually is the healthy thing to be doing. Really? You know, if you foresee you're going to have some negative emotions, playing the game while you're playing the game, and you don't want to get that mixed up with this other negativity that's going on in your life, I think it's very healthy to keep those things compartmentalized and separate, and not, you know, sort of leave it on the field, dude. Like you don't have to cross over the negative feelings in all the parts of your life and get some sort of terrible feedback loop going. That's probably the right thing to do, man. So, now, yeah. Interesting anecdote. For those of you who don't know, Aaron is a very easygoing, good-natured guy.
Yeah.
But in college, we had a little bit of a fun story. He, I, and another one of our friends were watching, we were binge watching the Twilight films. We were trying to force ourselves to watch it. We were getting horribly drunk while doing so. And Aaron is very calm, usually. He does not get angry at all. But he accidentally dropped a beer in his kitchen because he was kind of swasty pants, guys. Okay, it was really tough to endure all the Twilight movies.
Yeah.
We actually didn't even finish all of them. So we only got through like 2 1/4 before it was just like, I can't take it anymore. But anyway, so Aaron accidentally drops something and it breaks and, you know, the glass shatters. It's a big mess. But when you tell the story to other people, as our friend and I did, we would say that he got super angry about it and just had to smash the beer on the floor because Twilight was so bad. So key point here, if you tell people false things, you can develop false impressions to give to other people about how angry Aaron gets.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if this is applicable for someone in your life, but we had fun doing it.
Yeah, it was.
It also helped a lot that Aaron at that point had really long hair and looked just like Andrew WK. So
yeah,
we could easily convince other people that he does in fact party hard.
Yeah, it's the only time I ever partied hard. So you guys got a great story about me partying hard.
Yeah, a poorly told story, but a funny one nonetheless.
Yeah, that's a good story, though. I enjoy that moment. And I actually kind of was mad that I dropped that beer, because I think it was like the last one that I'd had, too. And, you know, obviously watching Twilight is painful, and why we would subject ourselves to a marathon of that, it still seems like a dumb idea, sitting in this chair.
Oh, yeah. Well, fruitfulness of time? Absolutely not. But sometimes you just got to take a look in the mirror and be like, I'm tough enough to do this. And you have to go out there and face the world that's full of things you don't want to do.
Yeah. Or see.
Or see. Or sit through. Or, you know, just discuss ever for any reason. Goddamn Forks, Oregon.
So what's a habit that you've stopped or started since you began playing, Eric?
The first thing that comes to mind is that over the last couple years, actually really just in the last 2 years of playing Commander and trying to like explain Magic strategy to a lot of other people, because I've had the beneficial and rewarding position of being able to teach several people the game over the last couple years. And also, you know, I've been writing, obviously, a strategy articles for a few years now. So that's really helped develop me mentally. But I've started getting into the habit of, before I decide whether or not to mulligan my hand and like evaluate my own hand, evaluate your opponent's hand. And like, this is interesting. I want to, you know, sort of divorce myself from the idea that this sounds dumb, because like, they know a little bit about your deck. You know a little bit about their deck. You don't get to see their hand, but whether or not they're choosing to keep their hand should tell you something about it. And you have to assume that if they're playing the game at a high mental level, they're going to be thinking, okay, I know Eric's deck is just full of rotten cards like Thoughtseize, and I have to keep a resilient hand that can interact early on and also generate some card advantage. So thinking through my thought process, I'm like, okay, opponent has to keep certain types of cards, or, you know, in combination to be relevant in this game. So I will now make my mulligan decision to react to that information, not just my own, you know, internal process.
So
that was kind of a roundabout, poorly explained way of saying I have developed the habit of thinking about my opponent's likely hand first before deciding whether or not to keep my own.
So a couple of things to think about with this. I think that, number one, this works really well in playing, well, obviously 1v1, particularly, because number one, you only have one person to consider. Number two, you have people with the fundamental assumption that are trying to play at a reasonably high level. I mean, for the most part, you know, I don't really know how you do this in Moto, but I think the biggest question is what kinds of like tangible examples can you give, and has it been effective?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Moto. It's obviously a lot harder to read people on Moto because you don't get the volume of information that it is their physical presence. So much of our communication is nonverbal that you can get huge amounts of information just watching someone's body language while they play. Obviously, you have no reliable indicators of what you're getting from Moto. Like, they could be tanking for a long time. Excuse me. They could be tanking for a long time on a difficult decision, or somebody might have just rang their doorbell, or their dog might have just puked on the floor, or they're making a hot pocket. Like, you can never reliably interpret any signals you get from the other side.
Yeah.
So it's tougher on Moto. I will absolutely say that. Maybe it's even a fruitless pursuit. I don't know. But when I know the person that I'm playing against on Magic Online, that's when this is most successful. Because you really have to know something to sort of get yourself going. And the best example I can give recently is I've seen this guy with a Kozilek deck, and I've talked about his deck with Mark and I with you and several other people, because his deck has really impressed me. But it's just full of the most brutal, like, hateful cards. And, like, you know, I have to be ready to play against things like Ensnaring Bridge. You know, I have to be ready to play against, you know, multiple strip mine effects. And that's when I see him, like, I know I'm in for a good game, but like, he's always playing the same deck from my perspective. I'm always playing a different deck, and it's usually a deck that I'm testing right now, like, you know, like, hasn't got all the kinks out. So that adds this extra dimension of challenge where, like, he doesn't know exactly what I'm up to, but I do know what he's up to. And I have to sort of get into his head and think, like, well, what associations does he have with this deck, with this general? Because that's all he knows. You know, he knows I'm constantly testing different decks. He knows he has a really strong competitive deck that is going to be able to pretty much roll over any nonsense that I might have. But I'm usually not playing just terrible decks.
Right.
I'm trying to find out how good something is, so I'm playing the best version I can make.
Yeah.
It's interesting. But yeah, like, in terms of his deck specifically, the example is he's just got these great, like, hardcore artifacts that, like, I know he's going to be looking to get in as many of those permanents as possible. Yeah. And that's the strategy. It's like disruption first.
Yeah.
And it's permanent based disruption.
Yeah. Interesting.
So because of that, I have to keep a hand that's capable of dodging around that, or, you know, blowing up multiple artifacts, something like that, or countering some early spells, because a lot of these things are either two or three you know, Thorn of Amethyst type stuff.
Oh yeah.
So.
Well, one of the interesting things that I was thinking about while you were talking was you and I both watch a lot of LSV on Channel Fireball. We've watched a lot throughout the years for the last five or so six years, just LSV jamming games on in draft and all these other things. And one of the funniest things that I think, and one of the best qualities that I think LSV has, is that even on Modo, the minute that somebody plays a land, he can figure out what deck they're playing and how, and like just by the land that they play. And it's really amazing to me a lot of the times because he's like 80% right. It's one of the most, I'm not kidding. Like it's uncanny really. Especially in like modern, I've seen him do a lot of Modern and Legacy. Like he's able to do that just at the drop of a hat, and it's impressive to me. I mean, I know that there's, you know, certain decks and, you know, all these different things, but being able to tell the difference between like an, you know, some Affinity deck or like a Grixis deck or Rug, you know, like a lot of decks play Steam Vents. The fact that he can tell when somebody drops a Steam Vents, he's like, oh, that's a Rug deck, you know, that's Rug Delver or whatever, you know, deck they're playing. It's impressive to me.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, a key skill for competitive players in every format but Commander, because you have to you have to figure out what they're playing. In Commander, we show each other. You know, we do this little courtesy dance. We're like, I will be using the pistol. I will be using the rapier. Let us duel. You know, it's kind of you never get to experience this in Commander, which is kind of a net negative in my opinion. But I don't know how else you do it. Like, do you keep your Commander secret? That doesn't make a lot of sense because, like,
yeah.
I could just do shady things in real life, in person. I don't know. Yeah. That would cause more problems than it would solve. But he is very good at it. You know, a lot of people don't know this, but LSV, pretty good at Magic.
Yeah. People, you know, people like to make fun of him on Twitter and be like, see you in the booth on Sunday. And it's just not really fair to him because...
Ooh, harsh.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, when you're on the guest or pretty much a co-host now on a leading podcast with, you know, in Magic, and you're an ace at draft and you have a really good insight into the game, you have a very high volume, you know, stream channel, Twitch channel, you're bound to get some people that know how you play the game. Right. So I think that that's really what happens to LSV more than anything else, is that people just know how he plays because they've seen him play so long.
Well, I think his commentary is just an asset for the community. It's absolutely taught a lot of people to play Magic and to play Magic better. And I'm right there with those haters on some level. I'm like, yeah, for sure I want him to lose super bad so he can be in the booth and I don't have to listen to Ian Duke, you know.
Oh, yeah.
the hosts, the commentators, they're okay, but they're not thinking about the game at the same level that a first ballot Hall of Famer, Pro Tour winner, all time wins in a tournament record holder, you know, platinum level pro is. He's better at the game than almost everybody else on the planet. He's one of the best commentators the game has. So if you match those two things up into the same person, you're damn right. I want him doing commentary on every event all the time.
You also forgot level 3 flavor judge. And he's also some like pun master. I think that they've added those two accolades onto his things. But other than that, you were pretty spot on.
Yeah, he may or may not have made a pun or two at some point.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think either of us can say anything really bad about LSV. We love LSV. Getting back to our topic though. So another.
Yeah, I was about to ask. How did we get here?
Yeah. So another. Getting back to our topic. One of the other things I've done. I think since I first started playing, but more recently than ever, is that I've gotten in a really good habit of putting my decks on the Tapped Out and making regular updates. For me to be able to, you know, it's one thing to just have a whole bunch of cards laying out and be able to look at them and access them at any moment, but it's another thing to be able to look at them in an organized, clean way that you can manipulate them and playtest them on Tapped Out. That's the only site I'll recommend to you. I don't like any of the other sites. Tapped Out is the one. It's just a great way to be able to exercise your brain in a different way and think about your deck in a different way because you've got the data and the statistics.
Yeah, I really need to get in that habit. You know, we plugged Will doing his deck update series.
Yeah.
The alpha build last time on the show. And I'm so bad at this because, like, I really do just play the tits off a deck and then, like, I put it down forever.
Yeah.
And as new sets come out, I never take those new cards and insert them into old decks so my decks get outdated pretty much just a couple months after I've stopped playing them, which is annoying if you want to come back and, like, pick it up again or if you need to reevaluate the archetype because something key has changed. Because at that point, I really have no convenient way to just change, like, a couple cards because now it's, like, 13 or 14 cards that have changed, you know. So I have to change a lot of cards and then decide, well, larger things about my deck are now different because I've changed so many cards, and I have to go back and be like, okay, let's take a look at the entire deck and my entire collection and sort of do a little bit of a fundamental rebuild here to make sure everything matches. Ugh, it's so laborious. I really need to, that's a habit I need to get into.
It's so, I have to tell you, like, well, one of the other things too is, you know, I think you're, because you build decks with the intention of just testing them, and then if they're not good, just, you know, put it, or even if they're good, you know, just putting them away, never looking at them again. You know, when you build decks with the intention of wanting them to last, you put more of an emotional stake in it, you know, like, whereas you're playing the stock market with decks, I'm, you know, investing in one company and working with it from the ground up, you know.
The stock market terminology is going long.
Yeah.
For that strategy.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. So I have to say it's really helped me out, and I have to say it's really, really, really cool that we're getting to see this kind of transformation with Will's decks. And my hope is that more people will, you know, I don't really like the idea of having to do that all the time. Most of mine, I just keep it in one version because it's just a lot easier for me to remember. But I'm really happy that we get to see the transformation with Will's deck from alpha to, you know, shadows essentially, or whatever or Eldritch Moon or whatever, whenever he's ever going to be able to finish that. Cause it seems like it's going to be a very long time before we get to modern sets.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it'll be quite the project that he signed up for.
Yeah. So just developing, I think in general, a discipline towards the way you play Magic, it really helps you compartmentalize your Magic playing and overall just add, you know, just saying, this is the way that I play Magic. And now the rest of my life isn't just about, well, there's Magic cards everywhere, but I have to cook dinner, you know?
I know a lot of people like that play Magic.
Right.
That has never been a problem for me, I don't think. I think maybe like two or three times have I ever been making a deck and like left it on the kitchen table or something where like I go to do something else. I'm usually pretty regimented with my time and I don't begin a task unless I have enough scheduled time to finish it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a person who has to like have things laid out for me. So like I, you know, I'm always doing other stuff and then coming back and looking at a deck or that's another thing too, that another habit that I've had that I think is successful too. Being able to put a deck together, play test a couple of times, say, hey, maybe I like this. And then coming back to it like an hour later, because you get a set of fresh eyes after you've gone and, you know, you've actually cooked dinner and now you're after dinner and you're like, man, I'm full. I'm not starving anymore. This is the way that I think when I'm not starving. I think that's important. We talked about goldfish testing a lot. That's another habit that I've done. I know that you've talked about it a little bit too. What are the things that you do in goldfish test that make it that help you improve your playing or your deck building or whatever?
Well, all I really want to know is like the net number of cards I need to get through to find a kill.
Okay.
And I don't necessarily play out the game like I'm, you know, versus a ghost opponent in Mario Kart. You know, I'm not playing my land and cast the spell and bolt their hypothetical creature. Like that stuff will happen. What I'm really looking for is like, can I do something that will most likely in the game, like play a Titan with counterspell backup or, you know, combo out, I don't know, like cast Cruel Ultimatum, you know, an example I've used as like a, you know, this will win. It doesn't actually win, but it's like, this is my theory. You know, it's good enough for the goldfish testing phase. And that's all I'm really looking for. And I want to know, like, what turn that happens on, and how many cards I have to go through to find that thing. And I need to make sure that that number is reasonable. Like, it needs to be pretty quick, in my opinion. But it also needs to match up with my script. If I, you know, do like 10 goldfish hands, and I can't get any hand that is actually developing according to my script, I've done something wrong in the numbers phase. Mm-hmm. You know, like my design process did not go smoothly, or maybe I wasn't disciplined. Maybe I have too much clutter, things not at the correct mana cost, or, you know, the wrong types of cards. So I know I have to go back to the design phase even before I start playing this, you know, huge 50 game set. So that's what I'm looking for. And I think, in my opinion, that's probably the most reliable information that I can get from goldfish testing, because there's so much to go, you know, so much information that goes along with matchups, at least on the competitive end of Commander. Like, you can have a really great deck and it can perform great in your goldfish testing, but like, you never know if it has this key weakness to like, oh man, I have to counter or have to cast the spell, and if they have a 2-cost counter, like, my deck basically never works. And that is a gaping hole that you'd really love to know about, but you probably won't find out from goldfish testing.
Interesting. I think I'm the exact opposite of you. Like, I mean, that's not to say that I don't goldfish test in that way. There's a couple of decks where I feel like when I'm the threat, quote unquote, like Saffy, Eric's daughter, the infinite combos with Saffy, or Animar, you know, like, I know that that's my plan. So how quickly I get into that plan is how I end the game. But that's not how I would plan all my decks. The interesting thing is that I had a pretty decent controlled environment back home before I moved up here to Seattle, and I had 3 or 4 guys that I was playing with every week, and they not only brought their play styles consistent, but their decks were varying, but they played them the same way. So like, I could anticipate, you know, understanding, well, okay, well, this guy's going to bring, if this guy brings this and this and this, long story short, I could essentially metagame some of these guys a little bit, at least the ones that tried to make better decks and tried to, you know, have cards that were just better than everyone else's. I could play with worse cards and be more successful because I knew what I was getting into. So with that said, I was able to metagame. So my goldfish tests were geared more towards, okay, just making sure that I have this card at this time, or a reasonable way to interact with this card at this time. The deck, I call it the Hirobi test is what I called it, because the Hirobi deck was real in our group. And it was basically, you play Hirobi, or you tutor for stuff. You find like Phyrexian Arena, you find anything that lets you double your mana, Cabal Coffers, Crypt Ghast, Magus of the Coffers, etc. And then you start dropping indestructible things, and you play Hirobi in between all these things with Cauldron of Souls to kill everything, right? I mean, this is the Hirobi deck. And what I ended up doing was figuring out ways to stop it and interact with this deck in different ways, with across the color pie. You know, if I was playing white, like, okay, well, how do I stop this? Well, I was playing Helm of Obedience. I think that's the one. Yeah. Helm of Possession. I'm sorry, not Obedience. Helm of Possession, in order to interact with Hirobi. So if I, you know, had a token, you know, a little mono white derpy token, I could sacrifice it to target Hirobi to kill it. So I was using Hirobi as a removal spell against itself. And, you know, just having these different effective ways to handle problematic commanders or problematic decks. If you have a deck in your meta that's like the best deck, you can sit your deck down and go, okay, these are the cards I need to beat it. And so that's kind of the way that I build it, is like, what are my opponents going to play? How can I get around it and do just enough to win?
Well, that's probably a good place to wrap up this conversation, because like, metagaming for everyone out there is a habit you should get into.
Yeah.
Maybe you feel a little icky about metagaming your friends. But you know what? That's what Magic is all about.
If you respect, I mean, it's to me, I mean, you and I have talked about it. I think it's a sign of respect for your opponents that says, hey, you know, I know you play a whole shitload of enchantments. You know what I'm going to play? Leave No Trace. You know? Like,
yeah, well, it's the thing is that it's not personal. And here's another good habit you should get into. Eric preaches about things instead of talking about himself. But like, don't take anything personal. And it's not a personal attack on you if like someone changes their deck in order to be more competitive in a game against your deck. That's the strategy
that's the
of
best compliment
the game.
You can get. The best compliment
well,
you can get.
I mean, it doesn't have. I'm arguing for the idea that it doesn't have anything to do with you or personalities interacting. It's just like, that's the point of the game. That's how you win the game. You need
Absolutely.
To do that.
And you play to win the game.
If you're not doing that, like, I don't understand what you are doing in Magic.
Yeah.
You're on straight up like Timmy philosophy where like, I want to make sure I have every persist creature in play at the same time. Like, you have a non-winning goal. And I, you know,
the bingo
we've
card.
Talked about this a lot. We've talked about this a lot of times, but like, if you don't tell me that ahead of time, I just get really sad. Like, I wanted to play this game, and now we have to play this other game, and now because we didn't communicate, everyone gets frowny pants.
Yeah, the bingo card, the Timmy bingo card, is a set of achievements. If you get them all in a row, you win, right?
Yeah. Well, you win, but only in like your personal satisfaction.
Yeah.
Everyone else doubly loses because like not only is their game ruined, but they found out they have a weird friend that like doesn't like interacting with them.
And plays
their
games.
Relationship with you has been ruined.
And on top of that, plays games without you to play games with you. Because they're playing.
He's just using you for your own entertainment.
Because Timmy, that's how Timmy Bingo works, right? You are creating ways to create to unlock achievements. In other games where you were trying to win, but you just want to unlock achievements.
Oh, well, that's exactly what it is. I actually think that's sort of like the most rude thing you can do in a game, Commander. Like, I don't mind if you counter all my spells and only attack me and kill all my creatures, but like, that's not rude. That's the game. Like, that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
What's rude is when you're using me for your own entertainment. Like, you're essentially masturbating. You know? You're like, we're not playing Magic anymore. You're going through your Steam account and being like, do I have 100% on everything? If I don't, guys, we have to run this, you know, contrive this scenario where I can get all, you know, every Cat Warrior token in play at the same time.
Yep. You have to win with Baron
Weird.
Glory. Win with Baron Glory. All right. So we've got to wrap this one up. We've got our last thing on the docket tonight is that I have in fact gone through and made Alistair Sleuth Extraordinaire, as we talked about on our last episode. And I think, I would like to, ask Eric to evaluate this card really quick. Does he like what I have so far? Cause we have a text box we have to fill.
Well, yeah, we have not gotten to the meat one might say, but name.
Yeah.
A+.
Cool.
Color configuration. I just don't know.
Okay.
It's okay. Like, if this is supposed to be like an Innistrad style card, like they don't have three color things, but they did have blue white, and I feel like Sherlock Holmes would be a blue white. I don't know why he'd be a black card, but that's relatively minor. You know, in the game of Magic, the mana cost will more often be dictated by what's in the text box rather than the other way around, you know?
Right.
So, okay. Like, if we give him black-like abilities, the black will be justified. So that's
okay.
That's almost a non-starter. Now, 3-4 for 4?
Yeah.
Okay. This I can get on board with. You know, that's not a bad set of stats by any stretch of the imagination. There's been a lot of 2-2s for 4 coming out recently that I'm not a huge fan of. I think we can do better than that. Human advisor, I guess detective is not a creature type.
Yeah, we don't have detective. Advisor was the closest one.
Well, maybe they'll be able to correct that in Shadows Over Innistrad. Maybe we'll get our first human detective.
That would be awesome.
Eh?
That would be awesome. So anyway, what I was going to say about the black was that I did it kind of off feel. So when I designed this card, I went immediately to blue white. I was like, yep, this guy's blue white. And then when I looked at it and it was two blue white up top, it just didn't look right to me. And when I put the swamp symbol there, I was like, this makes sense because, you know, I don't look at just Sherlock Holmes and think, you know, this is the knowledge guy, this is the, you know, the justice guy, this is all these things. He's also the opium addict, you know, like he's also this, you know, sort of madman who's a little crazy. And so I thought that adding the black symbol, that's the reason I did it. So, because I want this card to have all those things, not just the cool things that we all know about him, that making him super smart and all these other things.
Yeah. Well, two things. Three things. You're right. That is correct. Second thing.
Yeah.
Blue, white, black just looks better on cards. So, like, I'm always going to think that's a cooler card than just a regular blue, white. Like, blue, white is...
Yeah. Okay.
It, could it be much more played out? Like, I know Esper is, like, as far as three color combinations go, it's not, like, the world's most exciting thing, but any three color card is more exciting than a two color card to me.
Yeah.
Just as a rule. It's got more going for it if all I get to see is the color of the border, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Last thing. This is, like, a Sherlock Holmes callback, right? But, like, yeah. Are we just assuming that, like, he has some sort of tragic character flaw? Because normally magic characters don't. You know, they don't even have enough dimension to really have a backstory, much less multiple notes of sorrow and realistic pain in their life.
Mine does. Mine do. This is how you make better magic characters. This is how you make better magic characters. So this is the way I want to do
it's
it.
True.
So I came up with a couple of different ideas. And I guess we'll run them down real fast and see which ones you like. So I don't really think we need to have any static abilities. I just thought that was a thing. I have Vigilance, Hexproof, and Intimidate. I think any one of these could fit on here, but I don't really like them. I think he needs a pair of tandem rules triggers. And so I have two different sets, and I'll read them off real quick. When Alistair enters the battlefield, exile all creatures and artifacts. For each permanent exile this way, put a clue token into play under your control. So this is like the idea that he walks in and he's the wolf, you know. They set the wolf on him. He's interrogating all these different guys and he's looking for clues. And then the second ability would be, at the beginning of each end step, return all cards exiled by Alistair this turn to the battlefield tapped under their owner's control. What do you think about that? Those two sets, those two rules.
Huh. Let me make sure I get this. So, like, you take away everybody's stuff, and then you get all the clue tokens.
Yeah.
But then at the end step, all the things come back anyway.
Yeah.
So, well, I'll tell you right now, the way that you have templated this, I would hate it on Magic Online.
Yeah.
Because it has an instep trigger that will continue triggering even though it's not doing anything intelligent most of the time. That would infuriate me. But I guess I don't know if it seems right to have you get the clue tokens for everybody else's stuff. Like, shouldn't other people have some of the clues and maybe you don't have access to them?
Yeah,
presumably if you had every clue, like, you could just solve the mystery, right? There's not a whole lot of mystery. Just look at the information.
Well, it's just kind of him.
But I think you're onto the right thing there.
Okay.
I like the spirit you're going for.
Okay. So that's one of them.
We're 90% of the way there.
Yeah, that's one of them. The other one is at the beginning of each opponent's upkeep, put a clue token into play under your control. And then the second part of that rule's schema is at the beginning of your end step, if you control 10 or more clue tokens, you win the game. Or at the beginning of your upkeep, if you control no clue tokens, you lose the game.
Wow. Okay, well, in multiplayer, that would sort of work. But in single player, I feel like you're just likely to be dead.
Right.
They cast their Alistair. You get a token on their upkeep, and they blow it up, and you lose. Done.
Well, you get to sacrifice it, I guess, to draw a card, because that's what clue tokens do.
Yeah, sure, but like at the beginning of your upkeep, you won't have a clue token, you will immediately lose the game just because they had a naturalize in their hand.
Okay.
That would make you feel pretty foolish.
Yeah, that would be pretty foolish. Okay, well then, you know, this is why we're developing. So
we've done a lot of you make the card style stuff recently.
We
must fancy ourselves designers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're doing a pretty decent job. So if you guys have any I guess input. We'll go ahead and I think we'll leave it right there. Yeah. We'll continue the follow-up next week because we want you guys to tweet at us or talk to us and tell us if you have any ideas for helping us design our Sherlock Holmes style character. So if you guys like our idea, go ahead and, you know, post in the comments below. Tweet at me at Uncle Landrops or don't tweet at me. And we'll sign off there. Don't play the mimeoplasm and don't eat vegetables. Have a good night, guys.
You should just make a new Twitter handle.